Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, 50 years as Flag City, USA. The Hancock Historical Museum is hosting a celebration in honor of the title that has become synonymous with Findlay's identity. Also this morning, to your health, being outdoors is great, but the heat of summer can put extra stress on the heart, which is why learning CPR skills can help save the life of someone you know or even someone you've never met. And do you have a senior pet in the family? Just like us, their health needs change as they age. We'll tell you how to adapt your care routine as those furry friends get older. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, June 5th, 2024. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started. This one was one that I saw on the state rundown on the Newswire. Ohio stories. It says residents and business owners affected by the Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine are now being notified about how to claim funds from a class action lawsuit. That was the $600 million class action suit after the derailment back in February of 2023. It spilled toxic chemicals near the town. Those who were affected by the derailment, and this is what actually caught my eye in this story, those who were affected by the derailment are eligible for compensation ranging from $250 to $70,000. And I mean, I don't mean to laugh. I mean, obviously, it's a very serious subject here. But how do you determine who gets $250 and who gets $70,000? That seems like a very wide range. And I'm not sure exactly how they are going to determine who gets what. But how would you like to be the guy who gets $250,000 or $250 when your next door neighbor gets $70K? You know what I mean? That's weird. But anyway, those who are affected are being notified via letters being sent out. It is everyone who lives or works within a 20-mile radius of the derailment site. The deadline for responses to the settlement is August 22nd. So, if you know someone who might be covered by that, tell them to watch for that in the mail. $250 to $70,000. Wow. Another Ohio story that I happen to see on the Newswire. Ohio's newest state park is opening up this weekend. It is the Great Council State Park, officially debuting to the public on Friday. It's in Greene County. It is very small, only roughly 1 acre in size. 1 acre. You will be able. That's like basically the lot of, I think my house is on 3/4 of an acre in town. So it's very small site. Guests will be able to visit the Cultural Interpretive Center to learn about the Shawnee Indians who lived in the area and the historical figures they interacted with back in their day. Great Council State Park, right off of U.S. 68 between Xenia and Yellow Springs. So, if you'd like to visit beginning this weekend, you can just head south on 68, keep going, and you'll run right into it. But don't blink or you might miss it. One acre in size, the newest state park. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. We always have something to be worried about. We have something, some story about things to fear, be worried about. We're all going to die. This is today's we're all going to die story. A study from German Aerospace Center researchers has found a link between drinking and sleeping during an airline flight and strains on your heart health. Now, this is very important to note during the summer vacation season. If you are taking a flight, don't drink and don't sleep on the plane. They used 40 healthy participants in this study between the ages of 18 and 40 years old. And they asked them to sleep in a normal laboratory setting. And then they also had them spend the night, or had them sleep. I don't know if it was spend the night, but had them sleep in laboratories that were pressurized to simulate flights and travel on an airplane. Some of the participants were sober and others imbibed before sleeping. And the participants who drank and slept in the pressurized lab saw their blood oxygen levels sink to 85% or lower. And as we learned during the pandemic, you get down below 85 in your blood oxygen level. That is not a good thing. So those who drink and slept, or those who drink and slept in the pressurized chamber, a la a jet airplane, had this issue. They also experienced jumps in their heart rate. At higher altitudes, the body has to adjust to thinner air and lower oxygen levels, and alcohol, they say, may disrupt this process. So, don't drink and sleep on the plane, lest ye die. And you, I mean, you want to get where you're going, right? You don't want to kick off mid-flight, so that's what we're worried about. And if that's not enough to worry about here, check this story out. New study shows that late-night eating boosts the risk of developing cancer, specifically colorectal cancer. Now, there have been lots of studies showing the risks and benefits of what you eat, but this study, it's out of Chicago's Rush University Medical College, is the first to look to examine and uncover a link between eating late and developing colorectal cancer. Researchers studied more than 600 individuals who are getting colonoscopies and found that nearly half of those admitting that they were late-night eaters were more likely to have non-cancerous lesions that can develop into cancer over time. So late-night eaters, you may be, you're going to die. That's what it is. You're going to die. You eat late at night. Scientists think it has something to do with the disruption of the body's circadian rhythms due to the late night eating. So don't eat right before bed. You know, skip that late night snack. If you get up in the middle of the night, don't go down and, you know, make yourself a sandwich or down a bucket of ice cream or something. You know, it's not, you're going to die. There is good news, though. And this is a study out of Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is in, is that in Boston? In Boston, Philadelphia? I know it's someplace on the East Coast. Brigham and Women's Hospital. We've talked with the folks at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Very respected medical facility, research facility. A new study looked at medical data for more than 25,000 women over the course of 25 years. So a pretty extensive study here. 25,000 women over the course of 25 years. And what they found was that women who follow a predominantly Mediterranean diet live longer. Women who follow a Mediterranean diet live longer. Now, I don't know about the men. This study only looked at women. But those that predominantly followed the Mediterranean diet had a 23% reduced risk of mortality for all causes. And I love when they put this in the research study synopsis. So at a 23% reduced risk of mortality for all causes. Does that mean that one in four women will never die? It's a reduced risk of mortality for all causes. Isn't that basically, doesn't that say you're going to live forever? I mean, I don't know how they can determine that. Anyway, now the Mediterranean diet generally means high in fruits and vegetables, nuts and legumes, fish, healthy fats, and less red meat. So that is the Mediterranean diet. And again, they only looked at women, so I don't know if men have that same benefit or not. But I thought we would counterbalance some of the bad news with that item. And finally this morning, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This is one of those how did you spend your summer vacation story for these kids in North Dakota. Three kids have discovered the bones of a juvenile Tyrannosaurus rex that could help scientists learn more about how these animals developed from, what do we call baby T-Rexes? Are they puppies? I don't know. From juvenile stage all the way to adulthood. Liam and Jessen Fisher discovered the bones along with their cousin Caden Madsen while exploring Hell Creek, North Dakota. The kids sent a photo to Dr. Tyler Lyson, who later led an excavation team to uncover the full fossil. Juvenile T-Rex bones are rare, and such a find could help researchers learn exactly how the predator grew from a hatchling. Oh, there you go. That's what it says here, the hatchling. That's it. Juvenile T-Rex is a hatchling. The find could help researchers learn exactly how the predator grew from a hatchling to a fearsome 8,000-pound adult T-Rex. So that's pretty cool right there. I mean, that's... can you imagine going back to class in September? So guys, Liam, Jessen, Caden, how did you spend your summer vacation? Well, we uncovered a baby T-Rex. So we went to the beach, we rode our bikes, we played video games. We uncovered a baby T-Rex. Classic overachievers there. No, that's really cool, though. And the other thing that jumped out at me when I saw that story is, Mom and Dad, let that be a lesson to you. Don't be upset with your kids when they go digging in the backyard, because you never know what they might find. It might be a scientifically significant discovery that they are working on there. There you go, some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Showers and storms possible today, a high around 80. Showers possible tonight, a low in the mid-60s. It's been 50 years since the city of Findlay was officially declared Flag City USA, and the city is inviting the community to join the city in celebrating this milestone.
I'm super excited to celebrate 50 years of being Flag City USA. It's really an opportunity for us to continue to show off our community and our patriotism and celebrate the designation that we received from Congress 50 years ago.
Findlay Mayor Christina Mern says she hopes to see flags displayed outside of every home and business leading up to Flag Day on Friday, June 14th. Get more on how Findlay became Flag City USA in the story on our website. Despite opposition, oil and gas exploration continues in Ohio's state parks.
A 2023 law requires the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to allow fracking for natural gas in Ohio's public land and state parks. Fracking is the process of injecting liquid into the ground at a high pressure to extract gas and oil. A request has been made to the state to open an additional 2,300 acres under Salt Fork Lake Park, that's in Guernsey County, for drilling. The state can, in fact, now offer these opportunities to the highest bidders.
ONN's Clay Gordon reporting. The Findlay Police Department is putting on a fun event for the kids this weekend, the Bicycle Rodeo.
We'll host a series of different bike courses and educational activities. We'll also be giving away free bicycle helmets, bicycle licenses. There'll be a bicycle helmet and bike decorating station, as well as safety lessons, bicycle inspections, agility and road courses.
As Officer Brian White mentioned during the Bicycle Rodeo, there will be a series of different bike courses and educational activities, and bike helmets will also be given away. The Bicycle Rodeo will be held Saturday morning in the parking lot at the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts. Get more in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com. Matt Demchek for 1330 WFIN and 95.5 FM.
So now our cover story this morning, and I have to admit, I actually was a little surprised when I learned that it has been just 50 years since Findlay was designated officially as Flag City USA. I would have guessed, if you'd have asked me how many years ago was it, I would have guessed many more years than that. It's just within my lifetime. About your lifetime. Sarah Foltz is with us from the Hancock Historical Museum. They are hosting a big celebration in honor of the anniversary of the title that really has become synonymous with Findlay's identity.
Yes. Flag City, USA, Chris, I would completely agree with you. When I initially planted roots here in Findlay a little over a decade ago, you see businesses. We have Flag City named
Flag
business.
Flag City, USA.
Yeah, and it's amazing how much our community has really taken ownership and pride in that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much before 50 years ago that the legacy started,
mm-hmm.
When John B. Cook started really pushing hard to have flags in every establishment, in every yard, and they wanted to keep that legacy alive by deeming us officially Flag City.
Officially,
USA.
But that official designation just 50 years.
Yeah.
I was surprised by that. For those that don't know, as you said, the history actually goes back. It predates the official designation. For those that aren't aware, what is the backstory and how did this all come to pass?
I'm glad you asked that because there's still a common misconception in our community that, Findlay must have had a huge flag manufacturing company,
right? Even today, yes. If you mention this to people, you know, near and far, that's the first thing that they assume.
Right, and understandably so.
Not the case.
But thankfully, Tennyson Geyer, and in collaboration with the Women's Chamber, Women's Division of the Chamber, really kept this legacy alive, like I said, when they decided... that it was just an amazing movement to show our patriotism, mm-hmm. and encourage all community members to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And they really wanted to keep that legacy alive. So when they officially deemed us Flag City USA, that was the hope. And I think it is still prominent today. And when you hit a milestone, like 50 years since that official title, mm-hmm. designation, it's a reason to celebrate and also reflect on how far our community has come and really just bring us back together and be united and say, you know what, this, we are Flag City USA.
Yeah.
How can we celebrate this?
Yeah. So that is a big celebration this month. It is coming up on Saturday?
Sunday. Yep.
Sunday.
Yep.
Okay.
Sunday, June 9th.
Okay.
Yes. We have a big family-friendly event. This is completely free to the public thanks to the Community Foundation's Fund for All community series, mm-hmm. of free events. And we wanted to make sure that this was an opportunity for, if you don't already know, to learn why we are Flag City USA. And there's a lot more tidbits of information in addition to how the flag has evolved. We do tend to celebrate in Findlay around Flag Day, which is June 14th. So we're choosing Sunday, this coming Sunday, 1 to 4 p.m. to bring people together. Campus will be open, tons of activities. Great for the kids because they'll enjoy a free snow cone. We'll have red, white, and blue snow cones. We will have a massive...
Just wait a minute. Oh, yeah. Let me jump in there. Can the grown-ups get the snow cones
Absolutely.
Too?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure.
Absolutely.
So I want a snow cone.
Everyone in attendance will get a free snow cone. And in addition to, children will go home with a free book while supplies last. There's a mobile Mazza Museum exhibit. We are going to do a presentation with Dave Haas about flag etiquette and proper disposal.
Very important.
And I think that's... a really good opportunity as well. Even if you aren't interested in the activities per se, we are a collection site that day for any unused or damaged flags, and we will make sure those get retired properly.
Terrific. So this is all happening on Sunday, the 50th anniversary celebration of Flag City USA. And it really is fascinating, the history. If you don't know it, this is an opportunity to learn more about how that designation came to be. A couple of other things that you have going on this month that we want to mention as well. Tomorrow, Brown Bag Lunch Lecture is on a very important, significant topic in American history.
Yes, I am incredibly excited for this. We have a special Brown Bag Lecture tomorrow, Thursday at noon, and this is actually going to be an exclusive film screening, and it is called The Lincoln School Story. So ultimately, this is about an incredibly inspiring story. It's a group of mothers who fought for school integration in 1954 right in Hillsboro, Ohio. And this is the first documentary on this story. So we are going to watch that film. And then Dr. Melvin Barnes from Ohio Humanities will be introducing that, answering any questions. And I think this is an incredible topic to feature.
That really is interesting because we think of the civil rights movement, especially in the context of the Deep South, where it was so ingrained, the separate facilities and integration was fought so fiercely. But this was a battle that took place all across the country, including here in Ohio.
Exactly. And this is even more relevant with our Brown Bag Lecture series. We'll focus on local history a lot, but it is also important to focus on our surrounding areas and any of our statewide history. And mm-hmm. knowing that it was obviously happening right here in Ohio. And I think this is going to be very enlightening and insightful.
I think it also ties in, and this is maybe getting into the weeds a little bit and maybe looking a big picture. If you zoom out, again, we talk about the 50th anniversary of Flag City USA and, you know, what that flag represents and celebrating our country and how far the community has come. This kind of plays into all of that on some level.
You're 100% correct. I think that it's important to, you can come from every different angle, but to look at how far we have come and those achievements and to be able to celebrate that, but also recognize the work that still can be done.
Sure.
And, you know, history never ends. And so, you know, 50 years from now, we're going to be talking about a whole slew of additional progress that our community has made. And that's exciting to think about.
Yeah. And also you have a book sale coming up, kind of bridging the gap between the Brown Bag Lunch Lecture and the Flag City celebration. You have a book sale going on at the museum.
Yes. So this is a new opportunity and it is actually perfect because it is starting tomorrow and we are pairing it with food trucks. So as we do a book sale Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of this week, there will always be a food truck on campus while we're doing this. So basically, why we're doing this is we have an overabundance of books that are not part of the collections. They are taking up much needed storage space because realistically, we house over 80,000 collections and archives. So we have the dire need of storage and resources all the time. And these are books that have collected over the years that don't fit our collections policy. They were never added to the collections. There are a lot of reference books. There's books on law, history. There's maps. There's cookbooks, all sorts of topics.
Okay.
And some of them are a little, look really, really cool. So if you're even looking for books like that are aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, just to put on the bookshelf.
For the shelf,
yeah.
And we wanted to use this as an opportunity to make sure that these go in good hands and go on shelves that they're going to be cared for. So we're operating this 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Thursday and Friday on our porch of the Hall House. And it's all suggested donations. Nothing more than $10, but come browse through. Saturday's going to be 9 to noon. We'll have Bluffton Baking Company on Saturday morning with cookies and coffee. And Thursday, we'll have Pull Up and Grill. Friday, we'll have King's Concession. So
those are good ones. Those are good ones. I was going to say, so is the book sale an excuse to have the food trucks there or the food trucks an excuse to have the book sale?
That is a great question. We wanted an extra tie
in. Both.
Yeah. So then over your lunch hour, you can kill two birds and be able to grab some lunch, browse some books. And this is also perfect for the Brown Bag Lecture tomorrow as well.
Absolutely.
So you can grab lunch beforehand.
So Brown Bag Lunch Lecture is tomorrow at noon, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that is free for members of the museum to attend, $3 for non-members. You can bring a lunch with you or you can come a little bit early. 11 a.m. is when the food truck will open. The lecture will start at noon.
Okay, and then in chronological order, then the book sale will be the next couple of days,
Yep, 10 to 4, Thursday and Friday. The food trucks will just be here during the lunch hour.
Okay.
And then if you can't make it during the week, Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon, you can stop by.
Okay, and then the 50-year Flag City celebration is on Sunday.
Yes, 1 to 4 on Sunday, completely free to attend, great for the whole family.
Make sure that you make time in your weekend to attend that. It's going to be a terrific celebration. And again, Sarah Fultz, the Hancock Historical Museum, with us this morning. Sarah, thanks very much for the update. We appreciate
it.
So to your health this morning, it has been a very warm spring. If that's any indication, we could be in for a scorcher of a summer. And while being outdoors is great, the heat, especially when we're overexerting ourselves can put extra stress on the heart, which is one reason why learning CPR skills is important to help maybe save the life of someone you know, or perhaps even someone you've never met. Jason Brunswick is with us from Blanchard Valley Health System. He is a registered nurse, clinical education coordinator. And Jason, thanks very much for dropping by this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
CPR is a skill that everyone should know. We've said this many times, been told it many times. But it's not something that a lot of times people, you know, feel comfortable with. They're worried that, you know, I'm going to do it wrong. I'm going to do more damage than, you know, make the matters worse.
Sure. Sure. CPR is one of those skills we want to be able to know, but hope we never have to use.
Right.
CPR, just about anyone can learn it. There's been studies to show as young as sixth graders learning how to do it. I had a 10-year-old yesterday going through class, and he was able to effectively do it, and pass all the skills checkoffs with those. CPR, very important. If you don't perform within the first couple of minutes, there is a less of a likelihood of survival afterwards.
That's really the key, you know, because with any medical emergency, especially with respect to a heart attack, stoppage of the heart, if it's not started immediately, then the chance of survival goes down dramatically. How do we know when it is appropriate for CPR, though? I mean, just because someone passes out or collapses doesn't necessarily mean CPR is the right course of action.
Right. So there's a couple different pathways that we teach with CPR, whether you're a medical professional or a non-medical professional. Medical professionals will look for a pulse. They'll check for a pulse for at least 5 to 10 seconds. And if there's no pulse, then they're going to start that emergency response and begin CPR. Mm-hmm. Non-medical professionals will teach them to look, are they responsive? If they're not responsive, are they breathing? In the event they're not responsive, they're not breathing, then you're going to call for help and begin CPR.
So the other thing that's interesting is that over the years, CPR has changed somewhat. I know when I learned CPR in high school, it was kind of interesting, and this has been like 40 years ago. CPR, passing a CPR course was required to pass your health class, and you had to have your health credit to graduate. So you had to have CPR training in order to graduate high school. But it was different. It was the compressions and it was the breathing and all of that. And these days, what I understand is it's just we focus on the compressions.
So AHA did a big push. AHA being the American Heart Association did a big push years ago that was a hands-only CPR. Mm-hmm. What they found is only 40% of bystanders actually perform CPR for a multitude of reasons. One being that they don't want to have any legality issues, which you have your Good Samaritan laws to cover you for that. Mm-hmm. And then also they don't want to do mouth-to-mouth ventilations on a random stranger, right?
Yeah.
So they did a push for hands-only CPR for adults. Adults, you can kind of get by for a little while with just doing compressions and circulate the oxygen still in their bloodstream. Now, once you get to kids and infants, that's different. They do need the breaths for those individuals.
Okay. So, the other thing that I think is interesting is that I've heard that, you know, we have these online demonstrations and the public service announcements and so on. Basically trying to teach people to do this online, that anybody can do this. And, you know, but is a training course still an actual in-person training course still required? I would imagine it's the best option one way or the other. But
so the classes that we teach are through the American Heart Association. I know mm-hmm. during COVID they had some virtual options for a little bit, but right now there are blended options where there are online modules you complete, and then you have to finish up with a hands-on portion with an instructor. There are some that are just fully instructor-led, but there are some blended options as well.
So a lot of it kind of depends on what people are comfortable with, I would imagine, in that respect.
A lot of it comes down to time. So you can watch some of these videos will be, you can do it on your own time, and then mm-hmm. it just cuts down the time frame for being the in-person portion.
Yeah. One of the other things that has become much more common in recent years is AED machines. They are much more readily available than they used to be. And again, this is something that, frankly, for me, I'm like, boy, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this, but those are very smart machines.
Yeah, AEDs are essential to CPR. If you don't have an AED available, of course, CPR and doing your compressions, ventilation is important, but including an AED is just as important to include as well. For every minute you don't use an AED, your chance of survival decreases 7 to 10%. AEDs, like you said, are rarely available. You know, you see them in churches, any large gathering areas.
Yeah.
There are lots of different brands, but they kind of operate essentially about the same.
So how do they work? And kind of take us through this a little bit, because again, these can be rather intimidating, because knowing what you're actually doing, you're actually, you know, shocking the heart back, hopefully, to into a rhythm again. And that can kind of be scary.
Sure. The AED, once you get it on, there's pad placements, and on the pads, they'll show you exactly where you need to put on. The important part is you need good skin contact with the pads on the skin. Mm-hmm. So if they have a hairy chest, you have to shave. If they're sweaty or wet, you need to dry them off. But as soon as you turn the AED on, it kind of walks you through all the prompts. So it'll tell you, okay, now you need to open the pads, put the pads on. Once you do have the pads on, it'll start analyzing the heart rhythm. And it's going to determine, do we need a shock or do we not need a shock? Not every rhythm that the heart's in is a shockable rhythm. So if they don't have a pulse, they're not breathing, unresponsive, and it says no shock advised, we just continue with compressions because it's not a rhythm that we can kind of shock them out of.
That's the amazing thing, is that these machines can actually tell you whether or not it's, because like you said, it's not always the best course of action. So the machines can actually tell you this.
Yeah, and some of the times what they need, their heart's in this funky rhythm that they need to shock them right out, and they can quickly turn things right around.
Yeah. For those who don't know how to perform these procedures properly, you do have courses available.
Yeah, we have courses set up online at the public website for bbhealthsystem.org. Classes and events, depending on what kind of class you need, healthcare professionals would be a basic life support, where your non-medical professionals would be your heart savers, first aid, CPR, and AED.
While we're on the subject of first aid, real quickly, I want to mention that, you know, that is another important thing. This is the time of year when we're out and we're doing things. The risk of accidents increases, and basic first aid is an important thing to know as well. What are some of the things that people should know, you know, just as a, you know, in terms of basics with respect to first aid?
Sure. So you have minor first aid issues where, you know, you get cuts, scrapes, stuff like that, to where you want to kind of clean that with soap and water, get nice and clean, to where you might have some larger issues where you might have some large amount of bleeding. Anytime you do have that large amount of bleeding, you need to stop it, put direct pressure on it until that bleeding does stop, and of course, seek medical professional help right away.
And what are some of the things that people should have in like a go-to first aid kit?
So there's a couple different kinds of first aid kits available. Different requirements will require different things, but you're gonna want at least your gauze, your gloves. So your personal protective equipment is gonna be important, because obviously the person that needs help, we don't need additional people needing help as well due to exposures. Having the gauze, gloves, cleaning, any clean agents in there as well, bandages, things that you need to stop the bleed.
Yeah, always having that handy this time of year, very, very important. So, again, just a reminder, with people being out and about, you never know when some of these skills are going to be needed, when you might be called upon to save the life of someone in your family, a friend, or even, like we said, a perfect stranger. So, again, if folks want to learn more information, maybe sign up for a class. You offer those through Blanchard Valley Health System.
That's correct.
We've got a link up at our webpage, goodmornings.net. Jason Brunswick, again, Clinical Education Coordinator, Blanchard Valley Health System, with us this morning. Jason, thanks very much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Information that makes a difference. Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A funeral worker in Nebraska allegedly tried to take something unusual home from work. A deceased person's adult doll. Okay. Ryan Smith has been accused of breaking into the deceased's former home and seizing the doll, the adult doll toy. Well, I guess he figured that guy wasn't going to use it anymore. A coworker is the one that blew the whistle on this, noted that Mr. Smith had made a comment about the doll when they picked up the body from an apartment earlier in the day. Mr. Smith allegedly told an apartment complex employee that he needed the doll for evidence. All right. Mr. Smith has been charged with burglary, impersonating a peace officer, criminal trespassing, and tampering with physical evidence. Must have really wanted that doll. I don't know why. Well, I can guess why, but I'm not going to speculate. Let's see. Moving on in the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines. In Gillette, Wyoming, woman by the name of Dolores Frith said she took her dog, Tater, for a walk on Monday, but when they got back home, the pup seemed off a little bit. Just wasn't behaving normally. After a visit to the vet, they discovered meth in Tater's system. The dog was high. The dog was stoned on methamphetamine. It is suspected, the veterinarian suspects, that the dog may have picked up traces of the illegal drug during a game of fetch. Dolores said, I guess when Tater was returning the tennis ball, you know, she threw the ball, go fetch. And Tater brought the ball back. He somehow ingested some methamphetamine. Police were notified. They combed through the park where Dolores and Tater had gone on their walk. They didn't find any additional drugs. Fortunately, Tater didn't ingest very much of it, and he is now back to his normal self. But Dolores said for about an hour or so, his tail was wagging at about 100,000 miles an hour. His tail was just going crazy. All right. Well, I'm glad that Tater is okay there. His tail was going about 1,000 miles an hour. Let's see. This from Minneapolis, where a juror has been dismissed in a fraud case after someone reportedly tried to bribe the juror with $120,000 for an acquittal. Multiple reports say the person went to the juror, offered her a bag of money. Now, mind you, this is what's interesting. The trial involved seven defendants who were accused of stealing over $40 million from a program that was supposed to be feeding children during the pandemic. The case is part of a larger conspiracy involving 70 defendants and $250 million in taxpayer funds. The defendants are charged with spending the money on luxury items instead of feeding low-income children. So I look at this story and I'm thinking to myself, if you come to a juror and offer $120,000, you know, a bag of money with $120,000 in it, doesn't that kind of prove your guilt? I mean, you know what I mean? That may actually backfire in a major way. The trial is continuing with the remaining jurors sequestered as a precaution. But that may actually have worked against them, I'm thinking. We've had a lot of unusual thefts over the years in the broken news. What we have learned is that people will steal just about anything. Anything that ain't nailed down, and even sometimes things that are nailed down. Case in point, close to 100 fire hydrants have been stolen in Los Angeles County so far this year. Nearly 100 fire hydrants have been stolen in various unincorporated communities. They've seen about 85 of them disappear. 14 others have been stolen in Linwood, California. What are you going to do with 100 fire hydrants? I mean, of all things, you know, steal 100 fire hydrants. Authorities say the thieves are selling them at metal recycling yards. Although, wouldn't that be a little suspicious? You come up and say, how much you give me for this fire hydrant? You'd think that somebody would say, well, where did you get that? In South L.A., Golden State Water Company is now installing lock shields on fire hydrants to cover the bolts in hopes of making them tougher to steal. But the downside is that's probably going to make them harder to open up when they're needed to fight a fire. Stealing fire hydrants, of all things. Wow. And finally, in the broken news this morning, this is a story that I think just about every parent can relate to on some level. Peyton Handley. Peyton is a toddler who lives with her parents in Scotland. You could say she has a nose for trouble. Little girl had been complaining about a pain in her nose, and she had been having trouble breathing. And this has been going on for quite some time, like 3 months. This has been going on. They first thought, you know, maybe she just had a cold or, you know, congestion or something, and it would clear on its own. But after 3 months, they decided to visit the doctor, and initially, a visit to the doctor turned up nothing. But Craig and Kirsty, Peyton's parents, said something is wrong here. So when the symptoms persisted, the couple finally took her to Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow, where an ear, nose, and throat specialist solved the mystery. The three-year-old had a raisin lodged in her nose. A raisin lodged in her nose. Handley's recommendation to parents in similar situation, go see a proper ENT, an ear, nose, and throat specialist. Peyton is back to her normal self, now doing all the things she did before her medical incident, except no more raisins, her parents says. No more raisins for Peyton. 3 months she had a raisin stuck up her nose. There you go. That is, and like I said, every parent can probably relate to that on some level. There you go. That is today's broken news report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Did you know more than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for their news, traffic, weather, sports, and a community connection? AM radio is the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping Americans safe in dangerous times. This is News Director Matt Demchak. AM 1330 WFIN is here to serve you, and we take seriously our commitment to our listeners. We would love to hear what you value most about AM radio. Visit WeAreBroadcasters.com and tell us how you depend on AM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Have you ever wondered how long you will live? I think we have all at some point or another considered our own mortality, right? Well, some interesting research, a survey of 2,000 adults, revealed some interesting insights about people's considerations of their own mortality. It turns out that millennials, those between the ages of 35 and 44, believe that they will live to the ripe old age of 81. So folks who are 35 to 44 now believe 81 will be their lifespan. Conversely, their younger Gen Z counterparts, those under 24, are a bit more pessimistic, expecting to only make it to the age of 76. Now, mind you, those who are under 24, 76 probably seems like an awful long time, you know, an awful long way away. Probably longer away than 81 does for a 40-year-old, you know? One in six Gen Z participants aren't even sure that they will make it to retirement, which I thought was kind of interesting. But here's the kicker from this survey. Those over the age of 65 currently are the most optimistic of all, anticipating they will live until 84. That was the highest lifespan expectation of any age group, of any current age group. Now, also in the survey, men seem to believe that they will outlast women. Men predicted an average lifespan of 82 compared to women who pegged it at 80. Although, mind you, statistically, women outlive men, but not according to the survey. 65% in the of people in the survey say they sometimes or often contemplate their own mortality. When it comes to approaching life, 37% believe in being balanced. 20% say they want to live life to the fullest. And 16% say slow and steady wins the race. I don't know what that means in the context of approaching life, but be that as it may. But at the end of the day, regardless of the predicted lifespan, 59% of those in the survey worry about wasting time and not making the most out of life. So the long and short of it, at the end of the day, the moral of the story, seize the day. Well, it's a subject that many pet owners don't really like to think much about, the reality that our furry friends are aging, just like we are. And with us this morning to talk about how to adapt your care for your pets to those aging realities is Dr. Stacy Bone. He is a veterinarian and senior pet advocate. I thought this was kind of interesting. This was a survey from the American Animal Hospital Association. 80% of pet owners don't realize when their pets reach their senior years. Let me start with that question, Dr. Bone. When are our pets considered senior pets?
Yeah, Chris, that's a great question, and probably something that's going to shock a few people who are listening, but we typically consider pets to be seniors at about 7 years of age, and that's not something to be scared of, right? There's a whole lot of life after 7 years of age, so we're getting to the point where we're celebrating aging, right? It's a whole new chapter in how we look and care for our pets.
So how do we adapt that care routine as our pets age, because their needs will change over time?
Exactly, just like us, right? And I mean, recognition is the first step. But then it's understanding that even though aging isn't a disease, there are things that happen to us as we age that we just need to be aware of. And so it's monitoring your pets. And I can break it down into, it's really deviation from normal, right? We all know our pets. We've had them for years. We know their habits, how they act, what they do. And when they start to deviate from that, it's just be aware of it. Don't be scared of it and bring it up to your veterinarian.
So should we be taking them in for regular and preventative care more frequently once they reach that age of about 7 years old?
Definitely. And so proactivity is key. So at about that tipping point, if you're not doing twice a year veterinary visits already, it's time to start thinking about it. And even more than just getting there is being proactive in what you're bringing up, because I only get a little bit of time with you. So if you don't tell me what you're seeing or what you think is going on, then unfortunately I can't address it with you.
What are some of the most common things that pet owners should be on the lookout for when their pets get to those senior years?
Yeah, the first is going to be pain, right? Arthritis is a reality for dogs and cats both. Mm-hmm. And that can manifest a little bit differently in dogs versus cats. So for dogs, it can be like slowness to get up, difficulty navigating smooth floors. For cats, it's very subtle. A lot of time it's hesitancy to jump, hesitancy to jump up or jump down. It's changes in water consumption, eating habits, weight loss, just very subtle clues that you need to be aware of.
Okay. And also you bring up the point that nutrition needs change as our pets age. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the second step in proactivity. And so we talk about it at Hills Pet Nutrition. We talk about life stage nutrition, which is this concept that at every stage of life, just like in humans, your nutrition need changes. So a puppy or a kitten is different than a doll, is different than a senior. And so being proactive about changing that diet to one that is design for senior pets is unbelievably important. One of my favorite products is Science Diet Senior Vitality. It is one of our over-the-counter what we call wellness diets that actually has clinical research to show that in as little as 30 days, it increased energy and vibrancy in our senior pet.
Speaking of keeping our pets energetic, keeping them active is even more. It's always important. But again, as they age, how do we do that within their limitations as pets age?
Yeah, and I think it's different on every dog, right? And so I have two dogs right now. I have a senior dog and a younger dog that's five. And we just have to take care of them differently, right? So when we do walks, we'll go about halfway, we'll drop the older dog off at home, and we'll keep going with the younger dog. So it's just know their limitations. If they're starting to get sore, ease off a little bit. Low impact exercises like just walks or swimming is wonderful for senior dogs. And for cats, it might be something like move the food bowl a little bit closer. Don't make him go up and down stairs, things of that nature.
That being said, we do want to make sure that we keep our pets active as they age and don't let them become sedentary.
Yeah, obesity is the enemy of everything, right? So we got to keep them active. We got to make sure that we're feeding them the appropriate amounts and ask your veterinarian every time if your pet's getting a little chunky and start to be proactive about getting that weight normalized.
And I would be remiss if we didn't also mention that adoption of senior pets is a great option. I know for many shelters, senior pets are the hardest to adopt out, but they still, as you were mentioning earlier, have a lot of time and a lot of love left.
Yeah, and that's such a great point. And it's a little bit of a sad statistic. The ASPCA tells us that less than a quarter of senior pets get adopted. And we actually, my family adopted a senior pet last year. And it's amazing to see the transformation. I mean, I feel like it's kind of strange to say, but it's almost like these pets are grateful. And you worry sometimes you're only going to have them for a short time, but the numbers show us you're not, and those pets have a lot of love to give and a lot of time to give it.
Again, talking about appropriate care for our aging pets, as we were mentioning, most dogs will get to their quote-unquote senior years by the age of 7, much earlier than many people realize. It's very important to feed them right, keep them active, and keep them healthy as they age. Dr. Stacy Bone is veterinarian and senior pet advocate. Where do we get more information?
Yeah, so go to hillspets.com, and all you have to do is type in senior care, and you're going to get more information than you probably know what to do with. But there's stuff in there on how to adopt a senior pet, how to feed a senior pet, what nutrition is best, and just good general care tips.
Dr. Bone, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage, bookmark it, goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, on the 80th anniversary of D-Day, the Library of Congress wants to preserve the firsthand history of those who were there for the most significant day of what is arguably the most significant conflict in world history. We'll get details on the Veterans History Project. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.